Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Writers Aloud. This week we have Kate Cahoon exploring the responsibilities of non-fiction writers and Katie Grant on family history and the writer's duty towards the dead. First up, we have Kate Cahoon. Kate's a journalist and non-fiction writer who's written on subjects as diverse as historical biography, true crime, and cookery. Kate lives in London. Here she is with The Responsibilities of Fiction and Non-Fiction.
Truman Capote characterised his 1966 book In Cold Blood as the first non-fiction novel. Since then, the boundaries between fiction and non-fiction have grown increasingly blurred. You may, of course, say that to debate the difference between fact and fiction, history and the novel, is spurious. After all, even when dealing with the same subject, there is a clear difference. Novelists are able to articulate internal worlds, what their characters think and feel, while non-fiction must always, stringently, be about evidence. Yet, narrative non-fiction, from Mailer's Executioner's Song to Somerscale's Witcher, does begin to blur these boundaries, making the question about difference more complicated. I'm focusing on historical crime here not because the responsibilities or challenges differ from those of any other subject, but because violent crime, the evil implicit in it, does throw these authorial responsibilities into sharp relief. So, Capote, Mailer, Somerscale, me too, cannot invent motives, for instance, for their murders, however psychologically plausible or historically accurate. Instead, historians must find a way to accommodate the unknowable within their texts. That doesn't mean that we can't speculate, but our guesses must be both born of the known facts and be held apart and clearly signposted within the narrative. Historians, of course, are not the only writers to rely on fact to inform their work. Zola's La Bête Humaine, for example, arose from the notorious slaying of Judge Poinsot on a Paris-bound train in 1860. Then there's Shakespeare, who did it all the time, and hardly a novelist, I'd wager, who hasn't at some point based their work on something that really happened. Sometimes a real event is simply a springboard into a fictional world. At others, novelists rely on detailed research as a very necessary part of their creative process. It hardly needs to be said that for all historians, research, ideally using primary sources in order to guard against other people's mistaken analyses, misquotations, or wrongly remembered facts, is the only route to remembrance of people and the painstaking reenactment of historical events. But historians also borrow, don't they, from novelists. And I don't know whether Capote really was the first, but he did the kind of job that made the critics sit up and take notice. I mean that historians can use fictional techniques in the telling of their tales, such as the shaping of the story, the development of character, and the manipulation of pace and viewpoint. Asked whether he preferred to write novels or histories, John Lanchester recently said that they had one thing in common. Both required, in the writing, the skill of omission. At best, then, we can probably say that non-fictional representations of brutal crime can be, perhaps even should be, as involving as novels. Think how Truman Capote captures the soft, whispery rush of Perry Smith's voice, or how he horrifies us, not with the descriptions of Smith's mass murder, but with the image of his boots soaking in the motel sink, slowly staining the water pink. And remember how adeptly Kate Somerscale negotiates the difficulty of a young girl soundlessly lifting her half-sibling through the garden window in the otherwise soundless night of Roadhill House, a careful tenderness that intensifies the horror of what is to come. Let us agree, then, on the blurry line between the creation of fact and fiction. When it comes to murder, to the depiction of what we might call evil, are the responsibilities of the novelist and the historian also similar? Surely this is a timely question. We are enjoying another golden age of crime writing, fictional and not, literary as well as for cinema and for television. Yet violent crime figures are generally falling. So what drives our interest in the forensics of murder? There are those who argue that these flourishings of creative representations of crime can only occur when we feel relatively safe, when we have space, in other words, to allow ourselves to be frightened. Titillation does play its part, and always has. Critics of the sensation novels of the 1860s, the novels of Wilkie Collins, Mrs. Braddon and their like, wrote that these books drug our thoughts and reason, that they were pernicious precisely because they inflamed sensibilities. But I have another theory too. I would argue that we need to make ourselves feel frightened from the comfort of our armchairs in order to reassure ourselves that the opposite is true, that we really are safe. Historically, the greatest public anxiety arises when victims are respectable, middle class, ordinary. Think of Joanna Yates, or, in 1864, the subject of my last book, Thomas Briggs, the first person to be killed in a railway train in Britain, in a first-class compartment. Following Briggs's death, the Times trumpeted, "If we can be murdered thus, we might be slain in our pews or at our dining tables." What it was getting at was that apparently unprovoked murder, especially when it happens in privileged spaces, seems to prove that danger is random and invisible, that it moves on silent feet, and that it could not, therefore, be avoided. The murder of every man or every woman thus pricks endlessly at the horrible fear that our own existence could be plunged into a similar hell without warning. This victim, then, could have been one of us. Yet in the act of engaging with the story, in newspapers, in novels, in histories, in film or on television, we are able to reassure ourselves that it happened to someone else. I'd just add one thing further to this idea, that in anxious times, particularly during periods of rapid social and technological change, we hunger for stories that appear to prove that we, personally, are remote from danger. Part of the reason, then, why we clamour for the swift resolution of violent crime, or look for its satisfying detection in books and film, is that we want to believe in the preternatural infallibility of the detective. We delight in authorities' swift ability to solve dangerous puzzles, to reimpose order and deliver the illusion, at least, of certainty. And yes, modern crime fiction does often allow more of the sort of loose ends that would not have been allowed in the past, permitting the fear to linger longer, you might say. But we are very rarely left without a resolution, and may well be very shocked indeed to discover that a fictional villain remains on the loose. In the case of historical crime, killers are caught, and they are either punished, often irreversibly, or redeemed. Yet history just as often illustrates the absolute reality that it is impossible to get at the whole truth. Victims remain unavenged, crimes go unsolved. Even when arrests are made and convictions gained, motives can remain shrouded. We can feel that we have got at the truth, but not at its entirety. Which returns us to the overlaps between fact and fiction. Historians cannot make up internal worlds. They may, often, never understand motive. And we cannot be shy of these unknowables that I mentioned at the start. Indeed, it's a duty to allow them to stand, because history is not as neat and orderly as a novel can be made to be. Sometimes it's impossible to get at the whole truth. So, do novelists and non-fiction writers shoulder different responsibilities? History often raises as many questions as it answers, and perhaps its purpose is more overtly didactic than novels. I mean that it's not meant primarily to entertain, but to act as a lens through which to understand the past and, by extension, the present. Beyond the question of technique, then, how to blend rigorous history with journalism and literature, for example, lies a demanding axiom. To my mind, if narrative history fails to reveal anything useful about the society it reflects, or to make connections to the present, in other words, if it's no more than the story and no more than the sum of its parts, then it rather misses the point. It's a distinction of rather fine degree, perhaps, rather than of kind, because it goes without saying that the novel may also articulate deep truths about the society it mirrors. For the historian, though, the obligation is overwhelming, and when it comes to the retelling of crime or the depiction of evil, this is even more crucial. Precisely because we cannot invent or grapple with psychological complexities unless they're available in the primary sources, we must graft to provide context, sympathy, and analysis. Without these, our stories would be merely prurient.
That was Kate Cahoon, recorded by Carol Angier. You can read more about Kate on the RLF website. Her surname's spelt C-O-L-Q-U-H-O-U-N. Next, we have Katie Grant, also known as the novelist Catherine Grant and the young adult writer K.M. Grant. Katie's also a journalist and makes regular media appearances as a commentator. She lives in Glasgow and joins us to talk about what we do with our dead.
On a small table in the drawing room of my parents' home just outside Burnley in Lancashire is a small, very ancient leather frame. In this frame is enclosed a lock of hair, and the legend reads, "My cousin Frank Townley's hair, who suffered for his prince August the 10th, 1746. Frank Townley, or Colonel Francis Townley, was my five times great-uncle. He was born in 1708, the fifth son of Charles Townley of Townley, and a keen supporter of Bonnie Prince Charlie. Uncle Frank, as we always called him, was also the last man in Britain to be hung, drawn and quartered. And there his story did not end. His disembodied head was dipped in pitch and spiked on Temple Bar for a couple of decades, until eventually rescued and brought back to Townley Hall, then our family home, and now a museum and art gallery, in a haycart. Understandably proud of their hero, my family put the head in a casket and hid it behind the panelling in the domestic chapel, where it remained until central heating arrived. Central heating and Uncle Frank's head not being what you might call compatible, the head was given a new home, a basket with a napkin as dust cover, and the basket was kept on the dining room sideboard to be handed round after dinner with the port. Perhaps this after-dinner entertainment proved unpopular with guests. At any rate, in the end, Uncle Frank's head was popped into a hat box and sent back to London for storage at Drummond's Bank. It wasn't until after the end of World War II that Uncle Frank re-emerged, when the bank sent the hat box to my great-grandmother through the post. It was great-granny who finally arranged for Uncle Frank's head to be buried in St Peter's Church, and that should have been the end of that. However, when in 1978 a stone was to be erected to commemorate this gay and volatile martyr or traitor, according to your disposition, my mother had the tomb opened to see if the poor head was nicely settled in. Imagine the surprise of all the witnesses when the slab was lifted to reveal not one head, but two. One was certainly Uncle Frank's, with some of his features and hair still preserved by the pitch. But the other, who knows? Well, I know, because I turned the story of Uncle Frank's head into a novel for children. How the Hangman Lost His Heart was published by Puffin in 2006. My family provides an excellent supply of odd tales. Nobody questions the tale's use. But when I went home after the publication of the Hangman book and looked again at that small leather frame containing Uncle Frank's hair, it struck me quite forcibly that though I had written a neat story and certainly not besmirched his memory, I hadn't really thought much about Uncle Frank as a person. Yet he was a person, just as I'm a person, and although he died 267 years ago, I found myself asking whether it was really right to turn him into the quirky fellow I wanted him to be, rather than trying to be faithful to the person he was. The thing is, we commandeer the dead. We feel we're allowed. We feel in some way they should even be grateful, since our books, or more currently films, keep them alive, and in some cases, for example, Iris Murdoch through the star-studded film Iris, known to a broader audience than when alive. I'm talking, of course, about using the dead in novels, not about using the dead as subjects for biographies, as Claire Tomalin has so gracefully done with Charles Dickens, or Amanda Foreman in suitably lively fashion with Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire. Biographies are the respectable way of commandeering the dead. Novels and films are the less respectable siblings. Unlike biographies, novels and films rely on the fact that the dead can't sue, or at least that's the law at the moment. I'll get no writ from Uncle Frank. Legally speaking, whatever novelists do with the dead, we're perfectly safe. But what about the morals of the thing? Are we safe there too? Iris is a case in point. The point of her life was her writing. The point of the film was to track her path to dementia. As a result, to those not interested in literature, Iris Murdoch is the dementia person, not the writing person. God, what an awful legacy. I'd rather die, as it were. Yet the film of Iris is actually far more truthful than, let's say, my depiction of a 13th century Cathar heretic in my Perfect Fire trilogy. I came across this Cathar, the White Wolf, in my researches, adopted him and turned him into a manipulative fanatic. Since he's not a pivotal historical figure, in that few have ever heard of him, and he lived 800 or so years ago, you may think it's self-consciously over-scrupulous to care about the real White Wolf, because he was a real person. Anyhow, who knows, perhaps he really was a manipulative fanatic. But if we're saying that the passage of time makes his real personality a matter of no moment, then how do you feel about somebody 800 years hence turning Hitler, Stalin, or any of the world's most wicked and cruel people into characters for whom readers feel sympathy? To us, when these tyrants are almost living memory, this kind of transformation is impossible. Yet, particularly in films, the transformation from dead genocidal tyrant and mass murderer to noble hero is precisely what's on offer. In the film Mongol, for example, Genghis Khan is admirable. Richard the Lionheart is always depicted as lion-hearted, a lion-hearted believer in justice, as opposed to his brother, Bad King John, who tortured, oppressed and exploited people until he got his comeuppance and died of dysentery. In truth, Richard the Lionheart used England as a bank to fund his crusade and otherwise had no interest in the place at all. We simply accept without question that the passage of time grants us license to transform people's lives from what they actually were into what we, usually for our own purposes, want them to be. I'm currently disturbed by reports of a new film about the life of Alan Turing, the creator of the modern computer and a key player in the breaking of Germany's Enigma code during World War II. For all I know, Turing will be a hero in the film, but if reports are true, then the truth of his life, though well known, has not been respected. Why bother? He's dead, and it's open season on the dead, right? Respect doesn't come into it. Yet we ourselves want to be respected both in life and death. It seems that we're just rather more careless about respecting other people, though of course this may be a matter of taste. Though bothered about Turing and Iris Murdoch, for example, I'm much less bothered by Hilary Mantel's requisitioning of Danton, Robespierre and Camille Desmoulins in her novel A Place of Greater Safety. This is because Ms. Mantel is a great writer who has used her books to draw out these French revolutionary characters, and ditto for Thomas Cromwell in Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. She has respected the dead by doing something great with them. And Philippa Gregory might argue that though her books bow rather more to the modern reader's interest in, say, romance and incest, she has also respected the dead by bringing the forgotten to life, Mary Boleyn and Elizabeth Woodville, for example. Is it then just a matter of taste to feel that novelists like Mantel and Gregory respect the dead and more populist and less historically accurate authors have not shown quite so much respect? Is respect for the dead more about taste than morality? There's certainly an element of taste, perhaps even snobbery. I, for example, think that Colm Tóibín's treatment of Henry James is very respectful in The Master. I'm not so sure about Eleanor Hibbert, a.k.a. Jean Plaidy, in her treatment of Eleanor of Aquitaine or Mary Queen of Scots or the myriad other historical characters on whom she has turned her attention. It's not that I didn't enjoy Plaidy's books. I did. It's not that I think they're bad. I don't. Respect for the dead and enjoyment of a retelling of their lives are not dependent on each other. But there is a certain mark of quality about a book that respects the dead, or seems to, that's lacking in a book which uses the dead for its own ends. I'm not entirely sure what that mark is, but I think it's a kind of truthfulness which requires far, far more painstaking work than a sensational tale designed principally as a page-turner about somebody whose life seems to lend itself to such treatment. And are some dead not worth respecting? Do we care, for example, if Robert Graves' depiction of Livia or Caligula in I, Claudius is accurate? Livia and Caligula were real people. Absolutely ghastly people, as their stories have been handed down to us. Yet ghastly or not, one can't help feeling that, hundreds of years later, it doesn't really matter if what we do with them isn't entirely accurate, because their world has so completely gone, and respect doesn't really come into it anymore. Or at least respect in its conventional sense. Respect to people who lived eons ago is perhaps simply to remember them, to make sure they're not forgotten. They might be pleased enough with that. So what does all this amount to? This, I think, that despite all the above, we shouldn't be too prissy. Novelists should remember that the dead are not dolls. that whatever their histories and characters, often not relayed to us, of course, by themselves, but by others with personal agendas, at my Catholic school, for example, they never forgot that Elizabeth I was a baddie. Yet still, baddies or goodies, the dead are people, not playthings. If we alter their lives for our own purposes, we should stop at least once or twice to imagine their response to our treatment. We can afford to, because respect or not, you'll never have to face the dead in a courtroom. I do hope, though, that those dead people who feel that authors have maligned them find some way of getting their own back. As for Uncle Frank, it's said that he had a marvellous sense of humour and made jokes right up to the moment he climbed onto the platform for the hanging section of the hanging, drawing and quartering. Let's hope, then, that he'll forgive me for taking rather more literally than most the advice that authors who want to get on should, yes, you've guessed it, get ahead. If I meet Uncle Frank in the next world, he can give me his opinion then.
That was Katie Grant, recorded by Kona McPhee. You can read more about Katie on her website at www.katherinegrant.com. That's Katherine with a K and two A's. And that concludes episode 4, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 5, we have the Bulgarian-born writer Kapka Kasabova in conversation with Kona McPhee. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.